Day, I don't know, but if not, we can do it Wednesday. So, Scott, is it Gooden? Godden? Godden? Lisa? Come on forward. Chris Frost? Well, we have a whole bunch of people coming forward together.
Well, we didn't sign with Scott. Scott's with the U.S. Department of Commerce. My name's Mike Doyle. I'm with the Oregon Department of Economic and Community Development. I'm the International Director. And Keith Tetler, who is the state USTR liaison from the Department of Justice.
Okay. Sit down.
Amen.
Thank you. Lisa, I guess you have to wait just a second. Briefly, gentlemen.
Okay. My name is Mike Doyle. I'm the director of the International Division of the Oregon Department of Economic and Community Development. Just some clarification, I think, when you look at this memorandum, one of the basic tenets of this memorandum is that federal officials have not consulted with state and local elected officials regarding these constraints on state and local sovereignty, or even notified state and local elected officials when these constraints have been negotiated in international trade agreements. Actually, there is a process for the state to be involved through the U.S. Trade Representative's office on these particular issues. Keith Cutler from the Department of Justice, sitting to my far right, is the state's liaison with U.S. Trade Representative's office. Keith is the person responsible for getting the proposals that are brought forth by the USTR on international and multilateral trade agreements and dispersing them to the appropriate government agencies that would oversee these type of agreements. So there is a venue by which the state does have access to these materials and does have the opportunity to comment on these materials to the U.S. Trade Representative's office. There is also a system that is set up through the federal government, of which Scott Godden, who is the regional director of the U.S. Department of Commerce, is privy to, relative to a standing committee within the U.S. Trade Representative's office that does include the National Council of State Legislatures, which the state of Oregon is a member of, and does have the ability to consult with on all of these issues in an advisory capacity on the federal level. So I think that for the issue of clarification and to answer any of your questions, Scott, Keith, and I would just say that there is a venue by which both elected officials, state agencies, individual citizens of every state have the ability to access all of these issues relative to the USTR and unilateral, bilateral, multilateral trade agreements that is in place now and does work.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
Well, you've just opened a can of worms, buddy. I have a question for our Attorney General. In what context and to whom did you report on the component pieces of the WTO and the multilateral agreement on investments? Which people in the state were contacted, and what was their response to the information you gave them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, are you referring back to the time when those agreements were adopted or presently?
Could you state your name for the record?
Oh, sure. I'm sorry. Keith Cutler, KUTLER, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Justice. Let me take a step back, if I might. I've been serving in this role, and it's not a huge role, frankly, as the state point of contact for the United States Trade Representative since about November of 1998. As you know, these agreements were entered into years before that. I was not involved in the process at that time. My involvement now is that as the single point of contact, I am the name that the U.S. Trade Representative has for the state of Oregon government to send its notices out as it does on a regular basis. What that means is whenever they send out these items, and they do it by fax broadcast to my counterparts, I suppose, throughout the United States. I receive those, I review them, and when appropriate, I'll pass them on to other agencies within state government or to other counsel for affected agencies within my office.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Senator Corcoran.
So in the case of the WTO and MAI, you had no, that was before your time.
Exactly.
Would you get for us, please, some information regarding who the person was at the time, what information? I'd like to ask that person what they knew about the sovereignty issues, for instance, in WTO that didn't come to light to me except for information I received through my union, basically. I never saw this as a, you know, this is my fourth session here. I don't recall the legislature being exposed to any information about these sovereignty issues with regard to either WTO or MAI. In fact, it was Congressman DeFazio that told me about the Star Chamber proceedings of the WTO that can reverse statutes, which brings me to my second question for you, which is, when you're done writing here, I'll ask you.
Oh, go ahead, I'm listening.
Oh, you're multitasked, that's right. Attorneys are multitasked. I'm Irish, so I would have waited. Are there any statutes, Oregon statutes, that you can identify that have been challenged under these new trade agreements, as in the claim that's currently going on in California about that fuel additive?
Senator Corcoran, I'm not aware of any.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Just to amplify a response and some comments Mr. Doyle made, Senator Cochran, in the course of these negotiations, since 1974, the Trade Act of 1974 created an advisory committee system that whereby there are industry advisory committees, there are something called the Intergovernmental Policy Advisory Committee, and other advisory committees, most recently an actively committee set up from labor and environment to advise our trade negotiators on these issues in the course of their negotiations. The Intergovernmental Policy Advisory Committee is made up of representatives, mayors from Detroit, Atlanta, Cedar Rapids, Governor Kemp Thorne from Idaho is on it. State legislators are on it. These are committees that are briefed during the course of these negotiations to raise these types of issues. I won't, that is certainly a consultative procedure and mechanism that needs to be improved. And certainly as the administration seeks fast-track authority, this is an issue that needs to be treated. But there has been an advisory system in place, and as Mr. Doyle indicated, two of the groups that are paid most attention to in the context of these proceedings are the National Governors Association and the National Council of State Legislatures. Within the National Conference of State Legislatures. And within that conference, there is a assembly on federal issues. There are at least two Oregon representatives that participate in some of the subcommittee activities of that assembly. Also, the regional staff coordinator for the National Conference of State Legislatures works on the Senate side, works with the Senate staff here. So there are certainly avenues by which the concerns of the Oregon State Legislature could be communicated in these other venues that are paid strict attention to by our trade negotiators. But again, keep in mind that the very important views that you are communicating are also views that get put into the mix, if you will, with environment, labor, and dozens of other constituencies that participate in the process. And the process need be improved, but the point is that there is a process and there is provision for dialogue. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair, my only response to that is that, you know, before this became a tractor coalition issue, it was a labor issue. And I think it was to a great extent an environmental issue, although I'm not familiar with their participation in it. But it seemed to me that the only information we got, especially about the sovereignty issues, which I think are the reason that now we see the coalition getting larger to support the SJM2, is that this issue of sovereignty was vastly overlooked. And I'm just kind of curious if Mr. Doyle's claiming that, you know, OECDD or whatever its predecessor was getting this information, then it wasn't getting passed on to the legislature. I mean, I've been in the NCSL committees and heard testimony on
World Trade, and that's absolutely accurate. And, you know, they bring in folks from both private and public sector into those meetings, and we have long discussions there, but I've never seen it in the context of Oregon state government.
Okay. I believe so, yes.
Mr. Pelley?
Yes.
I apologize. I was delayed in a meeting in the governor's office. Thank you very much for being here. And Mr. Doyle, it's great to see you.
My pleasure, Senator.
I hope things are going well with you over in international division.
They are, ma'am. Thank you.
Mr. Cutler, and I apologize that this question has already been raised. Have you been involved in actually drafting provisions of the upcoming Free Trade Area of the Americas agreement, especially the provisions that impact state lawmaking authority?
Senator Gordley, no, I've not been involved in drafting anything like that.
Is there, if I may follow up, anyone in your office, the AG's office, who's had that kind of role?
I do not believe so. If I may, very briefly, I outlined the role of the single point of contact with the U.S. Trade Representative, which is the role I fill, as and what that role is largely as a conduit of information that comes to me from the United States Trade Representative to make sure it gets out to any affected or potentially affected agencies so that if they want to file any comments with the Trade Representative, they can do so. But our office is not directly involved in any way in drafting anything related to these agreements themselves.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. What's that, gentlemen? Representative Merkley, did you want to talk to this bill?
Yes, sir.
Senator George was here a moment ago, but he seemed to have left, so
he was going to go do his tax report.
There he is. Oh, Senator George, come up too, please.
Set of tires.
I wasn't going to mention that.
I did.
Go ahead.
So did
Representative Merkley.
Hi.
Oh. Let's let Senator George don't step there, too.
Oh, please. You guys are good.
We saw him.
Somebody let's get this thing started.
Mr. Chair, I'll be first as a good senator so I can learn more.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
All right. Nobody wants to talk about it. You know, yeah,
Mr. Chair.
We're too polite. We'd have never been born.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm here, as you know, representing Jeff Merkley, to address Senate Joint Memorial 2. I am here as a proponent of free trade. I support the establishment of an international trade regime that reduces trade barriers and encourages the exchange of goods. There are some factors in our current international trade regime, however, that I think merit close examination. And so I'm here to express my concerns and my apologies to my friends in the international trade community who feel these concerns have already been addressed, but I'm not sure that they have been to the satisfaction of the American consumer. There are four principles that I think are very important in international trade. One is that no tariffs or trade barriers be pursued or adopted based on a product's nation of origin. Every company and every nation should be free to pursue the sale of its product on an equal footing. A second principle is that consumers should have the information that they need and desire to make an informed choice. It's a very important component of freedom to have the ability to exercise your judgment based on knowledge of a product. And if that knowledge is blocked, then consumer freedom is essentially blocked. A third principle is that of non-infringement on local or national rules that local or national environmental rules that treat products of all producers equally. There's a very important clause called Chapter 11 that has two components. First, that foreign investors are no more favorably or unfavorably treated than domestic producers. And this is very much in concert with the first principle that I enunciated. And it would prohibit, for example, rules that are adopted solely to discriminate, such as we tend to produce large apples and our competitors overseas produce small apples, so we'll only allow large apples to be sold. Or we tend to sell products in glass jars rather than plastic jars, so we'll only allow glass jars to be sold. When these are essentially designed not to protect the safety and welfare of our citizenry, but to discriminate in favor of one nation's corporations, and they clearly run afoul of the principle of treating all companies and nations equally. The second half prohibits the direct or indirect expropriation of investment without investor compensation. And as stated, this sounds very reasonable and very important to international trade. But the way that it's being implemented has a perverse angle, and that is it actually gives foreign companies more power than domestic companies in the domestic market. If you are a foreign company and an environmental rule or a safety rule is adopted that hurts your product, you can charge that you have experienced indirect expropriation and sue for compensation. This then gives an advantage, actually, to a foreign competitor and goes directly against the notion of treating domestic and foreign producers equally. And some of those cases that have come from that have been some that continue to raise our eyebrows, and I'm sure there'll be a whole stream to come. One was where the Ethyl Corporation sued Canada because the nation banned the use of gasoline containing MMT, because MMT is a neurotoxin that has long-term health consequences. There was an effort to get out of the Canadian environment, much as we're now working to reduce the role of mercury in the Oregon environment. Or Methanex is suing U.S. to overturn the California law enacted to keep an additive out of products that was getting into California drinking waters. Very similar principle. There have been a number of other pieces related to step back to consumer information that I wanted to touch on. You may recall at one time we had cans of tuna that said dolphin safe or turtle safe. And this was based on international rules that were set up to provide releases out of the traps that allowed you to catch tuna without ensnaring dolphin or turtles, or at least giving them a chance to escape. Both of those animal groups, are air breathing. So if they were caught in the back of a net being dragged through the ocean, they drowned. And it was unnecessary. They had a way to release them. They sometimes lost some fish in the process. So you basically had an opportunity for an entrepreneur to say, I want to treat dolphins and turtles more, give them a better chance at life, realizing I'll lose some catch, but consumers may compensate by buying my product. And you'll notice that those cans have disappeared, or at least that's my understanding, because of a ruling under the international trade regime that informing consumers and giving consumers this choice was, in fact, a discriminatory practice. But in my mind, it wasn't a discriminatory practice that made the playing field unlevel. It was discrimination in its best sense, giving the consumer the ability to discriminate with their pocketbook for practices they liked or didn't like, regardless of the source of national source. Similarly, Europe is very concerned about the issue of introduced genes. We have seen in our domestic corn crop some of the challenges that occur when you introduce into a field an engineered gene that then has been drifting into neighboring fields. And in fact, we have seen an unusual situation where adjoining farmers who had nothing to do with the original deal have been not permitted to sell their crop for human consumption because their corn has become contaminated with the gene that was meant to stay on the field at somebody else's property. Well, this concern over genes is much stronger in Europe, and they would like to know when genes are in certain products. But it's my understanding that their ability to give consumers that power has been blocked under the same argument. The fourth principle I wanted to address was openness and accountability in resolving trade disputes. We can have a lot of faith in a criminal justice system or any justice system that gives us an opportunity to see how it's working, to see what arguments are brought out by the various sides involved, to see how they're weighed, and so we see both the substance and the process. And we can have very little confidence in a system that creates a system of secret trials in which we see neither the substance nor the process. From a state's point of view, we do not know if a state law is being challenged, whether or not the national government, our national government in our case, is advocating for the state's position, because we simply don't see anything about the trial. These four principles are completely compatible, but in the current regime, we have the first having been lifted up to a platform far above the other three. And I think in the long term, this is actually disadvantageous to appropriate free trade. And it's something that merits a close look. I think we have a very mild Senate joint memorial before us, which just basically says it's time for the state to pay a bit of attention to this, to take a look at how this issue is reverberating and report back to a future legislature. And I think that sounds like a good idea. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator George, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. State Senator Gary George, District 2. Dittos to that testimony. It was excellent. I believe it was in 1997 we're sitting in a committee, and I believe it was Ag and Natural Resources, and a bill was coming through that committee. And I was looking at that bill, and I thought, why would we do this? Would there be any reason that we would do this? And I asked the question, why are we moving a bill that looks like this? And the answer was, we had to respond to requirements that had been included in an agreement that had been reached, you know, between our country and another country. And I thought at the time, maybe the best thing for us to do is to begin every legislative session with a review of the Constitution of the United States and the foundation on which this union of nations, those states, was brought about. That literally their jurisdiction, their authority over the control of their own territory was very clear and was obviously, if you go back and look at history, hard-fought debates. Well, what has concerned me since then are these issues of jurisdiction, of openness, a court system that we understand, the right for us to negotiate fairly and without, in fact, certain things being proposed that will affect the well-being of our state citizens without the states being able to participate. I think to sum it up very quickly is that this is a very appropriate thing for us to be asking, that we be able to participate in an analysis of where we are constitutionally in relationship to these agreements, particularly with other nations, may not, in fact, be in the benefit of our state citizens, in other words, those job holders, in relationship to the environment, and whether or not we are being asked to compete in an environment that there's no way can be related to be fair or balanced. So I urge you to move Senate Joint Memorial too.
Thank you, Senator. Go ahead. Lisa.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Lisa Million. I'm commissioner-elect at the Tualatin Valley Water District in Washington County. And I have two issues with this. I support this joint memorial. The two issues I'm concerned with, one issue, water districts often contract with corporations such as U.S. Filter, which are subsidiaries of foreign companies, and to run water treatment facilities and such. And right now, I'm in a situation where the board is trying to reverse a decision based on public input and public pressure to help build a water filtration treatment plant along the Willamette River. We don't know how U.S. Filter is going to react to these changes. And I think it's very important that we understand, even on the local level with the water districts and fire districts and everyone, how these large agreements, how these national agreements are going to affect us in the long run. And another issue is, you know, the Methanex case recently came to my attention. I understand Methanex is suing the state of California for $900 some odd million for banning an additive which has been affecting water supplies because it's some kind of a substance that migrates through soil much faster than oil or gas does. So that's another concern of mine. I understand that the town of Spray has become, their wells have become so contaminated by this additive that they're drinking bottled water in this town. So, you know, to me, this is something that directly affects my ability to safeguard the water supply and the watersheds that people in my jurisdiction are going to be drinking, bathing in, cooking with. So I think we just need to have all the information we can. I'm concerned about this idea that the states and the local governments have been involved in this process, especially regarding the upcoming free trade area, the Americas Agreement, seeing as a lawsuit on the Freedom of Information Act was unable to obtain a copy of the agreement itself. And from what I understand, the text of the agreement was only released last week. So, you know, it seems like there's a secrecy involved. I'd like to see more open proceedings, more open discussion, and some real input instead of just, you know, a passive testimonial kind of process that we seem to have right now regarding these trade agreements.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I would just like to thank all of you for your testimony, and particularly my Senate colleague and colleague over in the House for your supportive testimony on this joint memorial. And I would like to invite you, as well as members of the Business, Labor, and Economic Development Committee, to join me in sponsoring the memorial.
Thank you, Senator Gordley. Chris Frost, Richard Reed, and Brent Foster.
Thank you.
Get right, big money. This is what they do.
Thank you. If you
could just nice.
Briefly outline your support.
Right. Okay. Thank you so much, Senator Beyer. My name is Chris Frost. I'm from the Oregon Clearinghouse for Pollution Reduction. I just wanted to comment on the AG's testimony and the provisions we have for the procedures of notifying at least agencies of some aspects of what the USTR is up to. These procedures seem to be woefully inadequate in terms of providing meaningful consultation to the USTR regarding issues of state sovereignty, and I will provide an example to suggest this. The WTO, the World Trade Organization, administers several agreements besides the GATT, the General Agreement on Trade of Goods. It also administers something called the General Agreement on Trade in Services. Now, this is an agreement you'll be hearing more about in the coming years as it comes into effect. But there is a current U.S. proposal for the General Agreement on Trade in Services called GATS that on transparency requirements. These transparency requirements would be effective at all levels of government, from the local to the state to the feds, that would require the following: that any level of government proposing a regulation that affects a service needs to institute procedures to notify all WTO member nations of the proposed regulation, that the rationale for the regulation be given to all member nations, and that there be a way for foreign governments to comment on these, and that a process for their comments to be taken into consideration. Now, countries that would be able to resort to a WTO dispute process should they decide that their comments were not given due consideration. There are state notification processes in effect now, but the potential for challenges from foreign governments on our ability to consider their comments is an entirely different thing. The potential impacts on state and local governments, should this proposal be agreed to at an international level, are devastating. The international unfunded mandate would impose incredible obstacles to state and local regulatory processes. Now, this is a U.S. proposal. It's being negotiated now at the international level. Have you guys heard about it? Has the AG's department heard about it? And if so, who did they forward the Federal Register notice to? Who's intending to comment on this? I have looked at the National Conference of State Legislators website, and I've seen, though I do think some of their material is great, I have seen nothing, no policy statements or any issues regarding the gaps. So, and I do understand their input to the process to be somewhat on the outside. So, considering the implications to state government from trade agreements currently being negotiated, this Senate joint memorial is extremely moderate, asking only for further study of these trade agreements and direct input from state and local legislators and citizens. I strongly urge you to support it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
if I just may comment briefly on your testimony, and again, thank you very much. With regard to the National Conference of State Legislatures, while they may be on the outside of the GATT process, as you say, they certainly are a clearinghouse of information for legislators around this country on the subject of trade and all of the issues that we're talking about in these hearings. They have provided my office and other offices with reams of material at our request on the subject. So, you know, just to let you know that we know the resources there, and we.
Mm-hmm.
Richard.
Thank you again for having the hearing. Excuse me. I'm Richard Reed. I'm with Mid Valley Jobs with Justice. And I'm here in support of getting Senate Joint Memorial 2 out as soon as possible, as amended. Trade agreements, as we know, have very negative consequences for working families, for states' rights, and for economic development. As you already know, Senate Joint Memorial 2 protects state rights from international trade agreements. Is there a problem with international trade agreements globally? Yes, there is. Supporters of trade agreements say they create jobs. They do not. And I've given this piece of information to you. It's got some graphs on it. Unemployment rates have continued to rise over the last decade in spite of the increase in trade agreements. Supporters also say trade agreements raise incomes. They do not. In almost every region of the world where economic policies of the World Bank and IMF are enforced, per capita incomes have decreased dramatically. Again, on that graph. Do trade agreements raise the standard of living? They do not. World Bank figures reveal an alarming increase in the number of people who earn less than $2 a day. That's equivalent to about 1 pound of food. Do trends look any different in Oregon? They do not. NAFTA's impact on Oregon is devastating. Oregon has lost 11,000 jobs directly related to NAFTA permanently. These jobs are gone. When workers are simply replaced and manage to find jobs, on average they earn 13% less. This report is really an indication of why a Senate Joint Memorial is very badly needed. But trade agreements create additional horrors beyond the thousands of victimized working families, and that brings us to Senate Joint Memorial 2. These newer trade agreements, especially the so-called Free Trade Area of Americas, are like giant Measure 7s. These trade agreements include takings provisions. In short, these taking provisions mock our judicial system and expose taxpayers to massive lawsuits. These provisions invite foreign corporations and investors to sue us whenever state or local laws or regulations might remotely diminish the foreign entity's current or future profits from investment in U.S.-based assets. What does this mean for Oregon? I provided this to you. It's why state legislators should be concerned. There are a host of Oregon laws which can be ruled illegal by trade tribunals under recently enacted trade pacts. I've included this piece. It has a whole list of groups of laws that are, in fact, affected negatively by these foreign trade agreements. There's just such a wide variety of zoning restrictions on land use, environmental preferences, standards for motor fuels, packaging prohibitions, local content requirements, business recruitment subsidies. It's all in here, and it's all subject to suit by foreign investors and foreign corporations. Since the proposed multilateral agreement on investment is still used as a foundation for trade agreements, we expect no difference between the proposed free trade area of the Americas and current NAFTA practices. It was referred to earlier that NAFTA's infamous Chapter 7 on it supposedly levels the playing field between international corporations, but it does so at the expense of our sovereignty. Here's some examples I provided for you. Investment protection provisions, and in here it lists a few issues that are making their way through the courts now. You've got Ethel Corporation versus Canada. April 1998, Canada yielded. That was brought into the courts. Canada yielded. There's $17.5 million that went to Ethel Corporation, $4.5 million to attorneys, and the pollution Canada hoped to avoid is now technically legal. Canada hasn't appealed that yet. Another case found its way into the NAFTA tribunal. I don't know how it avoids courts and gets into tribunals, but Metalclad Corporation versus Mexico in 96. Mexico ordered Metalclad's toxic waste facility to shut down. It was shown to be a polluter. January 1997, Metalclad sued for $90 million. Okay, so it goes on and on in this vein, and that's why I provided those for you. Oregon's situation, of course, with Methanex, that was mentioned earlier. There were 10,000 drinking water wells in California. They decided to not allow Methanex in there. Spray Oregon still uses bottled water. There's more. It goes on. I have the piece from Harrison Institute for Public Law on federalism and foreign investment. This is for you if you want deeper background on it. Aside from the job losses and attacks on our sovereignty these trade agreements create for Oregon, there is one other factor we simply cannot ignore. Every economic development program in America, like Oregon's enterprise zones, strategic investment programs, and so forth, that promote economic, environmental, or social objectives are at risk because they may create de facto disadvantages to foreign investors. Examples include the domestic or minority procurement preferences, restrictions on the use of public lands, limits on gambling and casino licenses, regulated recycled materials markets, all investment incentives. All of these are now subject to suit by foreign corporations and foreign investors. Here we have taxpayers supporting economic development in the state, and in fact, taxpayers might have an additional cost of lawsuits if foreign investors prevail. So I'm just urging you again to get Senate Joint Memorial 2 out so as soon as possible. We deserve to know what is in these agreements, and we can't afford any more free trade. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Foster.
Good afternoon, Chair and Committee. I appreciate you again letting us have this opportunity. I'll be brief. My name is Brent Foster. I'm a private attorney from Portland, Oregon. I guess I just wanted to emphasize that while we may have different opinions on the value and threats of international trade agreements, and certainly we do within our own coalition, which is becoming more diverse every day from, you know, members of the Traffickers Coalition to environmental and labor groups, what this SJM 2 does is just ask that we know more. It just asks to study the effects. Maybe the answer comes back, there is no threat. And those of us who think there are incorrect. Maybe that would be the effect. But again, SJM 2 is not about is trade good, is trade bad. It's simply about whether or not we can take a close look at what these trade agreements do to local and state sovereignty. I've spoke with Attorney General Cutler specifically about his role as the point person, and I appreciated the fact that he was clear to point out that it was not a huge role, because in talking to him, I asked him some of the things that he had done, and essentially he acknowledged that his role was more or less, or described his role as more or less limited to passing on press releases. He was not involved and has not represented Oregon's view in the coming free trade area of the Americas or any of the other trade agreements that are working on. He essentially does serve as a conduit and an important one, but it doesn't in any way ensure that Oregon's laws are going to be protected in these trade agreements. So I again appreciate you hearing this. I urge you to support SJM 2, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on SJM 2. Open work session, SJM 2. Committee, we've just been handed the Dash 3 amendments that incorporate all the, we're checking to make sure they incorporate what was asked by the sponsors of the bill. And Senator Gordley is looking at us as I'm stalling for time so she can read and I'm trying not to bother her while she studies it to see if it says what she hopes it says.
I'm fine, Mr. Chair.
Senator Gordley moves.
The dash three amendments to Senate Joint Memorial.
Senator Gordley moves the dash three amendments to Senate Joint Memorial two.
Two to three.
Is there any discussion? Objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Joint Memorial 2 as amended to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Gordon moves Senate Joint Memorial 2 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objections? So ordered. So ordered. Would that carry it?
I'd be happy to. And Mr. Chair, I'd like to thank all the folks of the Economic Justice Action Group for their participation in the process and your patience and for being here today. Thank you.
Thank you. That will close the work session on Senate Joint Memorial 2. We'll now go to a public hearing on Senate Bill 209.
Oh, we're going to have a fight over this one, I can tell, lads.
Mr. Putman.
Oh, my God. Where are you going?
209.
Hey, if we have to sit and listen to this stuff, you do too, buddy.
I'm going to make it up.
Oh.
Senate Bill 209.
Bring up Atkinson's bill and they all
land on this bill.
Okay. Will you tell us something about it before Senator Atkinson?
They're all coming in.
Start in?
Crowd coming in. After they
come out. Yeah. Chairman and members of the committee, this bill places a $1 tax on tickets to professional live boxing events. Those dollars are to be appropriated to the Boxing Commission, and from there it's to promote amateur boxing. Organized amateur boxing in Oregon.
Okay. Senator Atkinson, I see you're ready to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jason Atkinson, State Senator, District 25. I will begin my testimony by saying up to about 3 years ago, I didn't know anything about boxing. However, I grew up, as you see do you all have this article that was before you?
Mm-hmm. I just handed them down. Oh, they only got
in that article, you'll see a photograph of a gentleman by the name of Joe Petrogetti. It's a family that I grew up with. Joe Petrogetti formerly was a fighter, a boxer in the military, and had quite a distinguished career. As a businessman, he was successful in his business and one day decided that one of the things that his family has always done is taken in athletes, student athletes, who've had a variety of interesting family backgrounds and just kind of taken them into his family. About 3 or 4 years ago now, he announced to his wife, Frances, that he was going to start a boxing club. And he did it. Actually, he did it and then he told her. And what this was created was Bulldog Boxing. And what he does is he trains these children, these kids, most of them who are from broken families, and he takes them in under very strict rules and start a boxing club. And this club travels all around. It travels north and it travels off into the states of Nevada and Idaho. And has actually other boxing clubs have actually started to grow. In particular, I think in this article, there's three of them listed in Southern Oregon. They box or compete rather in Idaho, and I don't know how many clubs there are in the northern, like up here in Willamette Valley or Portland. I say all that to say that Mr. Petrogetti and that family comes from the state of Nevada. Nevada has these surcharges that actually go into promote amateur boxing. This is one of the few states, Oregon's one of the few states apparently that does not, which leads us to this particular bill. This bill, as I think that article raises some awareness of, these people who start these clubs and try to get these kids to compete do it all on their own dime. And Joe's not looking for a free ride to travel, but he's looking to promote boxing for some of these other smaller clubs. And so what we anticipate is that even though this isn't a real big spectator sport here in Oregon,
We do think that this bill would generate about, we anticipate, I think, about $5,000, which would help some of these smaller clubs take off. The interesting thing is that, again, I told you I didn't know very much about boxing, but I did know a lot about this family. This particular, some of these kids are in his program now. The Joe goes to their student parent teacher conferences and has these kids maintain certain GPAs if they're going to participate in this sport, and has really been a success story in the southern part of the state. And so I'm bringing this bill to you to try to help Joe replicate this around the state. Now, why is it in your committee? The bill was actually in general government for some time, and I would like this bill to move. And so with the backlog that that committee had, I respectfully asked them to move it over to this particular committee. With that, I'd answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator Atkinson. Questions?
I have one, Mr. Chair.
Senator Deckard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Atkinson, do you have that article?
Mm-hmm.
In the background, in the picture, you can't really make out the fellow. He does look a little bit like you. He's got boxing gloves on.
Yeah.
And he looks like he's about to go into the ring. Is that you in the back of that picture there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckard, actually that's not my body. That's my head. It's actually a stunt double. But I will say that that particular gym, Job made in his, he made that in his warehouse. He has a furniture store, a small business furniture store. And in the excess space that they had in their warehouse, he set all this did all this on his own. And I believe that's right in their warehouse. I went to an amateur boxing. My first time actually was in Portland about 3 years ago. I went to one of these amateur, and I was a little bit skeptical. But this is actually, I mean, this is how Olympic athletes go all the way up through the ranks, is through little programs like this. And that's where I kind of got interested in it.
Mr. Chair, sometime when we're bored and we're getting amendments drafted or something, I'll tell you about this boxing match I went to in Panama Canal one time between Costa Rican and a Panamanian. What a friendly international conflict that turned out to be.
I can imagine.
About a cockfight, I went to the Philippines, too. Years.
Thank you, Senator Atkinson. Would you like to come up here and make a motion for the bill to raise me?
That for a buck? You know what they do?
That's more referral.
You know what they do at a cockfight? They bet on the duck.
Do you know what the mafia does at a cockfight?
To make sure the duck wins. Okay.
Oh,
okay.
No, not really.
She's
on board.
Cause
she's a
nurse. No. I can't afford anything. I'm sorry. We have to.
You're my best friend.
Senator Atkinson, we would have to request in the Senate President's office if that subsequent referral be withdrawn. Would you like to go down and talk to him about that between now and when we adjourn our meeting? Or
I'll refer it. I'll get it out down there.
Would you like to make a motion to that effect?
To that effect, Mr. Chairman, I would make a motion that we move this to Ways and Means.
Senator Atkinson moves Senate Bill 209 to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Okay.
We have a motion. Is there a discussion, Senator Corcoran?
Well, the only discussion that I did want to have seriously is that it was brought to my attention that a couple of tribes might have a little bit of a problem with this, and that you might be willing to look at an amendment that has some language in that says in the case of tribes, they may submit a voluntary contribution.
Correct.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator,
Senator Atkinson said with such certainty that he would be able to get this out of Ways and Means, so I'd like to give him my list. I'll just say that.
Because we could request the Senate President to... I mean, if you really don't think it's going to cost any money.
Let me try that. Mr. Chair, can I remove my
withdraw your motion?
I withdraw my motion.
And we can put
it back crazy
on the schedule for another day?
Please.
Wednesday?
Thank you.
Okay.
What is this, rookie training?
With that, we'll close the public hearing. No, oh, I guess we never went into work session, did we? So that motion was out of order anyway. All right.
I'm still on those.
That's fine.
Okay, let's go.
We can do to help you through this process.
Right? Let's wait on. Let's do that.
Actually, there's a few things you could do.
Should we do
That's Anna.
Do we even want to do a public hearing on 463? Is Senator Harper want to talk about it?
No, he doesn't.
Do you want to talk about 463 today?
No.
Okay. Let's go into work session.
I heard a chicken away from me over the weekend.
Uh-oh. Take some time off.
Yeah.
Work session on Senate Bill 801. Mr. Putman, you like to...
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 801 as written prohibits refiners from limiting the sources from which franchisee can purchase that trademark motor fuel, and it also prohibits the franchisor from selling or offering to sell the fuel at a price that exceeds what the franchisor is paying in his own company-operated stations. There is an amendment to the bill that replaces the original language and requires instead a study by the Department of Justice on the competition of wholesale and retail markets, and lists a number of aspects that are to be included in that study, but doesn't limit the study to the named areas of review.
Okay. Senator Yorley?
Mr. Chair, I move the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 801.
Senator Gordon moves the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 801. Is there discussion on the motion? Seeing none, objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 801 as amended to the to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Senator Gordon moves Senate Bill 801 as amended by the committee to the Committee on Ways and Means. Members, we don't have a fiscal yet, but we have been assured by Department of Justice that a similar task force has generated a significant more than $50,000 fiscal, so we want to get the bill down there as soon as possible so we can find the money to fund it. Senator Deckert, did you have a comment you want to make?
I do, before we send it to Ways and Means, and I didn't know that it had to go to Ways and Means, but that is in part, Mr. Chair, because I wasn't involved with the drafting of this amendment. And I think that would be the nature of the comment that I make at this point, is that Senator Miller and myself and the chair was involved in drafting this legislation after numerous meetings. And then I guess it was about 2 weeks ago we had a TAP public hearing, and at that meeting I expressly indicated that I looked forward to, and then my office and Senator Miller's office went to work on arranging testimony that for our hearing, which was scheduled for Wednesday. We're going to go forward with that hearing. We have a U.S. Senator. We actually had two U.S. Senators that were going to be here. And I think it's just very unfortunate that we are now moving a bill forward in the legislative process without a public hearing. And effectively, the public was denied an opportunity to come and express themselves on this issue. And I think it is really unfortunate when that happens. And I understand, and I appreciate the chair's assistance in terms of bringing these bills and working on these bills and taking an interest in this issue. But I do think that it is unfortunate when we let the public out of the process. I think this is a circumstances where I found out about this amendment this morning. I read it around 11. I didn't know it had to go to Ways and Means because I wasn't involved in the drafting of the amendment. And I guess register my objection in that vein is that I think we have two huge responsibilities here, but first is to allow the public in to testify on bills. And I can tell you Wednesday we have a number of groups, of citizen groups, of folks in the industry, and we'll do a public hearing, but unfortunately it won't be the Senate Business and Labor and Economic Development Committee, because we'll have to do our own public hearing to have a good airing of that legislation.
I just
echo the objection.
Okay, is that an objection to the motion or objection to what we're...
Mine's just a general objection, not that.
Mr. Chair, I think the comment by Senator Deckert that has been joined in by Senator Corcoran is more than just a general expression. I think it's a very serious concern and complaint about process. and we need to hear it. We need to own that. And I just want to say that I join you in the concern that you've expressed, and would hope that as our committee work goes forward, that we don't do this again.
Noted. Okay. Any objections to the motion to send the bill to Ways and Means? Hearing none, so ordered. And we don't need a carrier.
Vote is just good.
What?
Call me up in the meeting.
Yes. We will now go to House Bill 3791. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3791.
Mr. Chairman, 3791 gives the Department of Transportation authority to set the minimum amount that a dealer can charge for the paperwork and other work involved in transferring a title. The minimum amount they can set is would be $50. The second thing the bill does is it increases the dealer's annual bond from the current $25,000 to $30,000 and then raises it an additional $5,000 a year over the next 3 years. And finally, it places a $20,000 limit on the claims against that bond when the claimant is not a retail customer.
Go ahead, Daryl. Looks like you must have signed up. I don't have the sign-up sheet yet, but you must be here to testify on 3791.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Daryl Fuller. I represent the Oregon Auto Dealers Association, and I assure you this will be the dullest bill that you hear today. House Bill 3791 does three things relating to auto dealers. First, it increases the bond required to be an auto dealer. The bond maintained a steady $15,000 from the 1950s to the 1990s. Last session, we changed it from $15,000 to $20,000 last year, from $20,000 to $25,000 in September this year. The bill, it continues to increase the bond that dealers have to have in $5,000 increments until we reach $40,000 total. Second thing the bill does is it reserves bonding amounts over $20,000 to consumers only. What we learned 2 years ago is that bonds which are intended to be for consumer protection, that only about 15% of the or 20% of the bond was actually being paid out to consumers when a dealership failed. The other 80 to 85% of the bond was going to other dealers and financial institutions who staked their claims earlier than consumers when a dealership failed. So by reserving the bonding amount over $20,000 to consumers only, we are in effect quadrupling consumer protection in this bill by increasing the bond to $40,000 and reserving half of it to consumers only. Finally, the third thing the bill does is take an existing $35 fee, which is in Department of Justice advertising rules, and moves that administrative fee to Department of Justice statutes regulating auto dealers' titling and registration of vehicles that we've sold to consumers. And it modestly increases the fee that we can charge consumers from $35 to $50. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Daryl, on that last point, you said it moves it to the Department of Justice?
No, I'm sorry. It moves it from the Department of Justice. It's currently an advertising rule under the Department of Justice. This moves it over to the Department of Transportation and their Business Regulation Division, where we do titling and registration work. And it changes it from an administrative rule at the Department of Justice to statute at ODOT.
And this amendment, it doesn't cap the fee. It says it cannot be less than $50?
The current fee is $35. It says that essentially that the fee will now be $50 and that the Department of Justice cannot reduce the fee by rule less than $50. Dealers don't have to charge the fee, and they don't have to charge $50. It's essentially dealers have the option of charging a fee up to $50, and they have an option now of charging a fee up to $35. This would allow the Department of Justice's cost increase to go above the $50, but it wouldn't allow the Department of Justice, or this could be, wouldn't allow the Department of Transportation to establish a fee below the $50.
Effectively a $15 raise.
Yeah, it's a $15 increase in the fee. The fee has never been increased since it was instituted.
And this is the fee that consumers pay?
Yeah, consumers pay for in exchange for the auto dealers completing the title and registration work.
So if I go to one of your dealers and buy an automobile, and they do the title and registration work, they charge me today $35 to do that?
They may charge you up to $35. They're not required to, and the consumer can opt to complete the paperwork themselves or to argue. Cars are a negotiated price item, so consumers can argue that they don't want to pay the $35 if they don't want to pay it. I said it's simply a customer service fee. It's not much different than the fee that other stakeholders get, whether they're selling a snow park permit or a fishing license. The difference between those and with auto dealers is that the state gives the cut to the retailer as part of the licensing fee. In this case, we don't get that guaranteed cut. The state allows us to charge a fee up to $50 or up to $35 if we choose to charge it. We're not required to charge the fee, and some dealers don't. But this simply is an effort at recouping our costs. For my dealers, for example, when you're a large volume dealer, you have a title clerk in-house whose job is to do nothing but fill out the title and registration work on behalf of consumers. That's their entire job. So essentially, we have an employee on staff who does nothing but collect taxes on behalf of the state of Oregon and fill out paperwork on behalf of consumers. That $35 fee that we're charging is an attempt to recoup the cost for the benefit the state receives and the fact that we collect an enormous amount of money on their behalf.
And we appreciate it, Mr. Miller, by the way.
And we think it would be a good idea, frankly, if you increased the title and registration fees. We think they're too low.
We'll have to ask Senator George about that, and thank you very much.
You're endangering your bill.
Can those last comments be stricken from the record, Mr. Chairman?
Okay. I'm still struggling with the language, but I think I understand now what it says. Monty, did you want to provide additional testimony while we're here, and I'm still making sure this is doing what you say it's doing?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Monty King. I represent the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association, which is the independent, non-franchise people. The costs of selling a car don't just include the title and registration, making out that paperwork. You have to keep the records for 5 years on the odometer. You need to keep the records for DMV for 3 years. You got to store this stuff. So, you know, some of these dealers have huge rooms full of files. You have to buy the forms. You have to pay for the employees. You got to pay for the employees to drive over to DMV to put the paperwork in. And then when they get back, you got to sometimes send stuff out, notices out. We recommend to all of our dealers, they do a Carfax on every car when they're selling it. That's $10. Okay, if we get into title and registration, electronic stuff in the future, if you're talking about maybe $15 to $17 to do electronic title transfer paid by the dealer. So there are huge amounts of costs that dealers do to take care of the process for the customer and the state. And that's what this fee is. Like we said, it's not mandatory. We don't have to charge it. They don't have to pay it if they don't want to. We would appreciate it being raised because it should have been raised a while back. I've been working on this issue for 2 years, and I think everybody's in agreement. This is the way it ought to be done, and we've got the bond increase, and it's going up step by step. That's going to protect my small dealers, my small businessmen. So if there's any real problem in the bonding process, we can maybe catch that halfway through. Because if I got 500 small dealers going out of business because the bond gets too high, that's going to create a lot of havoc in my industry. That's why you have the four-step $5,000 increases so we can see this thing happen instead of whacking it all at one time. Florida did a study on their bond. 85% of their bond was going to business to business. So this consumer only over $20,000 level, that's going to be terrific for the consumer. Terrific. So we support the bill. We think it's good for the public. We think it's good for the state. We think it's good for the dealers. It's win-win-win.
Monty, you said four step, but I see three.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the first step was already passed in 1999. It goes into effect September 1st, 2001. All right. But, and then we've added three more steps on there, going from 25 to 50. So right now it's 20.
40.
It's a 40, excuse me. Right now it's 20. It's already going to 25. But the 25 that already had been voted on and passed, we're now going to convert that into consumer-only bond level. It was going to be dealer-to-dealer, business-to-business, and consumer. So we're reserving 5,000 already passed 2 years ago just for consumers.
Questions? No. Daryl and Monty, you said this the fee is optional.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
How many consumers know that?
Mr. Chairman, we're required to. We cannot represent the fee as a government fee or as a required fee. The Department of Justice, as part of the advertising rules, specifically state that we cannot represent the fee as a required fee.
Was the Department of Transportation also?
Mr. Chairman, the Attorney General's office, while eliminating the fee portion of the advertising rules because it will be in statute, has told us that they will continue to have the advertising rule, which would prohibit us from indicating that the fee is anything other than an optional fee. So the requirements that go around administering the fee will not change.
Okay.
And we have agreement from the Department of Justice and the Department of Transportation in moving the fee over.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3791. Anybody want to raise fees? I'll go to work session if... Make sure I can count four.
You got the votes?
That's what I'm asking.
I'm a yes.
Okay.
Yes, two.
Huh?
Two.
Jason? Bob?
Yes, I'll smoke.
Work session on House Bill 3791.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Corcoran.
Move 3791 to the floor of the two passes.
Senator Corcoran moves House Bill 3791 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion on the motion? Any objections to the motion? So ordered. Senator Corcoran, you want to carry it?
I was going to offer Senator George, but sure, I'd be happy to.
Okay. Senator Corcoran will carry it. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3791. Senator Corcoran.
Well, I think Senator Decker's going to do this, but I was asked by Senator Miller to do this, serve notice of possible reconsideration of vote on Senate Bill 801.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I just looked up the proper motion to do the same thing, so I'm going to support the motion that's coming.
Serving notice of a potential.
Support it.
Yes. Senator.
Has it been moved?
Well,
I move.
You wish to serve notice.
I serve notice of possible reconsideration, having voted on the prevailing side.
Okay. So noted for the record. We will close the Committee on Business, Labor, and Economic Development. And Judy?
So, Judy, what does that do now?